Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now then, you're welcome along. So we have Rory O'Connor of the Irish Independent in studio, and we have Andy Dunn with us as well. You're welcome.
Nice show.
So, Operation Win the World Cup is on track, Andy. not quite. So, geez, a chastening couple of days, huh? Everybody's freaking out.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit myself, I would say, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is freaking you out the most?
There's about nine things at the moment.
Well, try and give Rory a chance to talk in this chat at some stage.
I'm trying to share it. I think what's freaking me out at the most is the lack of variation there's no willingness to move away from the way with which we've played in the last year, and the persistence of we're gonna do it better and implement it better when time is running out, and it doesn't appear to be any way close to implementing it better. It's actually gone the opposite direction, and that's freaking me out. Yeah, along with about 800 things, we'd say.
I think there's signs that they are moving on, but because everything else is going so badly, they haven't actually been able to show them. I thought in that first 20 minutes, we've seen them attack from fullback and counter, and in the Italy game, they're looking to introduce a bit of a counter-attacking game, which we've never had under Joe. They're starting to pass. A winger receives the ball, he doesn't instantly look for contact. He's throwing passes. Even Rob Kearney threw an offload. They're trying to play through the phases a bit more, but when they lose collisions, they're not being able to do it. It's not that I'm worried. I mean, Saturday was just such a freak of a performance and a result. I'm more worried about the fact that so many senior men are playing badly, the fact that the defence was showing up three England players waltzed in untouched. I know they're probably the more fixable elements, and maybe the changes they're making, because they're playing so badly in every other department, they won't be able to make them in time to show it in Japan. But I do think they're trying to implement some new stuff, but because they were so bad, they weren't able to do it, and they were kind of probably reverted to type as everything went to absolute pot at the weekend. Very late in the day to be pivoting, though. I mean, I do think that they will revert to type when they're under pressure, if that does come to pass.
We had more offloads than we normally do. We had less rucks, and that was something I consistently I would have criticised in the good days, and was getting equally criticised back to stop criticising success. But I suppose the old what's the if poem? You meet with triumph and disaster and treat the two imposters just the same. So I think when we were playing well, or certainly when the results were going well, we had a very labour-intensive game. When the results started to go badly in the Grand Slam, or in the 2019 Six Nations, we were still very labour-intensive and we looked to be tiring. So then we had way less rucks actually against England, which is maybe one of the only positives. But similarly, the line-out was obviously so bad. We had 37 missed tackles, I think, on the revised stats. So it doesn't matter how many rucks you have when that stuff goes wrong. Mm. So, there's lots going on swimming around that worries me and concerns me. Oh, yeah. I mean, the periodization stuff doesn't add up, doesn't make a lot of sense to
go
me.
Go on.
Well, I mean, periodization was... Gatland kind of introduced it back in 01, 02, 03 with the very successful Wasps teams. It works. Like, if this was called the Rugby World League and it's going on till June, it would feel more comfortable to have periodisation 4 weeks before the tournament starts. But you've got to try and peak. The idea of taking the players away for the 8 days and absolutely beasting them down in Portugal has merits. Don't know if it has merits then to go and play England and Twickenham. And like, it's not like they can't change their mind the day before. That was arranged in God knows 12 months ago.
Shouldn't the benefits of the trip to Portugal kick in by September 22nd though?
It depends. Like, what were they trying to achieve? If they're trying to achieve like growth and muscle mass or something like that, it takes 4 to 6 weeks of continuous work to gain muscle mass. So if they're doing a lot of weight training, they're tiring their legs out. I mean, if they tired them to that extent, but then sent most of them out onto the field, they're at risk of injury if they're that tired.
They've been in camp for the guts of 9 weeks. Say Portugal marked the end point of the really tough physical training.
Yeah.
They then have the guts of 4 weeks to get up to speed on a rugby front.
Yeah.
And equally, they should beat Scotland, all things being equal, and then you have another 4 weeks, three, 4 weeks to play your way up to speed for a quarter final. Like, really,
they're all fair. It's valid. Periodization is valid in my mind over a course of a season because you build that reservoir. I'm not sure if it's as relevant straight away in a knockout competition because you require momentum going in and confidence. And if you're going to physically effectively damage people for the week in order to make them better 4 weeks down the line, the knock-on effect, we got our arses handed to us on a plate for 80 minutes against England. It doesn't do anything for confidence.
A psychological price to pay.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever envisaged losing by that
much. No, they didn't.
And playing that badly. I think they always knew they were going to lose that game. I think Joe had written that off. I mean, that game is playing against England before World Cup is probably not a good idea. It's part of a commercial deal the IRFU signed a long time ago over and back games. I don't think it's ever Joe's idea. You know, I think he's working with a plan that he's been given. I think he thought he could get away with pitching up and maybe losing by 20 points and we'd all be kind of, you know, criticising. But I mean, everyone's lost the plot because of the nature of the defeat, and completely understandably so. But I think they are building towards something. It's whether they might physically be there, but it's whether their belief is still there by the time they get there, after that defeat.
Yeah, like psychologically, when you think about this year, the Aviva Stadium was a disaster. England coming to the Aviva Stadium. I mean, Joe Schmidt used the phrase broken, which was, you know, still this word I can't believe he used it really, because it just kind of jumped out so much. And then you go to Cardiff and suffer that humiliation. So then you realise, well, there's a real pattern here. And then they go to Twickenham and what happened. Like, think how vulnerable as a group and as a team they must be feeling now heading to Cardiff.
And now they're all thinking about their places from the captain down. Now they're all feeling vulnerable. And maybe that's the shock to the system that they needed. Maybe they all felt safe. And a number of them are being pitched back into the battle on Saturday. And I think the message to them is, perform or you're gone.
Mm.
So I think it may have clarified. I think in the long run, we could be looking at this, and it could be the start. We could be looking at this 2 ways in 2 months' time. It could have been the start of the disaster, and we look at it as an 07 again, or we could be looking back at the moment that Joe Schmidt almost rediscovered his ruthlessness and said, and realized, I just got real clarity that this thing is going one way, and I need to inject new life into it. And maybe that's putting Ty Byrne on the blind side and starting Jack Conan. You know, it's bringing James Ryan back. Obviously, he's obviously always going to play, but there's, you know, Chris Farrell, Will Addison could come in and suddenly change the picture on Saturday, but, you know, against Wales. Mm. This Wales away game is suddenly very important. Maybe it helps that Wales are picking a bit of a B team. Ireland can go over there with a bit of belief that, you know, it's a new team, a lot of them are undamaged by last weekend, and they all see an opportunity. So I do think that it may, in the long run, be okay in terms of getting to a quarter final. And I think the timing that you mentioned earlier in terms of the actual big game, the real big game, is not until October, could work out in the long run, because there's even time for the lads who are out of form now to get back into form. It's just beating Scotland.
Yeah.
But the belief thing is a concern, and the Six Nations, and all the messages last week in Portugal about, we're over the Six Nations, we're going to prove that we're even better than the team for 2018. That was what Rory Best said beforehand.
Yeah.
But I think they had such a nice time in Portugal, even though the training was hard. They were there in the sunshine. They just weren't ready to play England. And they weren't ready to play England as they said goodbye to Twickenham and set sail to win the World Cup. But all the lads looked like all their big ball carriers were in the best fettle they've ever been. And they just absolutely looked like they were playing a different sport. It looked like a tier two nation who had never been to Twickenham before.
Maybe a silly question, but you're obviously the expert when it comes to fitness, and you opened this conversation with periodisation. Mm. When you looked at England on Saturday, did any part of you think, they're looking mightily good now, they'll be doing very well to still look as good come November 2nd if they reach a final? Like, how long can you maintain that level and that fitness and that feeling that good about life? Like, do you want to be that ready this early? I'm really trying to find the optimistic slant in all this here.
I suppose my optimistic side is, there's no way we're as bad as we performed on Saturday.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that is the case. We're nowhere near as bad. That is an outlier. Joe Schmidt teams that have lost haven't lost that heavily typically. When we've certainly been tough to beat.
It's a record over 69 games.
Yeah.
It's a big enough sample size.
Yeah.
So there are big gains to be made. Line out will improve overnight.
England thing that you're asking, there's nothing wrong with I don't believe they're peaking now. I don't think they're peaking too early. There's a month to go to the World Cup, and I would have thought they, if you asked the England players after that game, was it a physically tough game, they probably said it was a canter. So it didn't take too much out of them. That's worrying. And then they've lots of momentum and lots of confidence, hopefully too much confidence.
Sure.
But
physically there's no...
Physically they're a bigger, bigger group. And so too are South Africa, and so are Wales. Mm-hmm. And we... You know, I'd love to see, I've kind of said it before, you know, if there's a pivotal moment maybe for Joe is to cede control. Like you're coaching, the best coaches facilitate your success or they guide you towards it. They're not the sole arbiter of your success. Like the players need empowerment. The players need to be given some more scope, I think. Raj was on during the week. Woody was on. I know you'd asked him about Rory Best and captaining a team. When you know, should you keep going when you're
not playing well?
And Woody's answer was like, "Damn right you do, because you're the captain." And you looked at Rory Best in the post-match interview, and he was demoralised. There wasn't a sense. Woody would have been a very difficult character for coaches because he had an opinion, and so did Raj, and so did Paul O'Connell, and so did O'Driscoll. Is anyone on the playing staff asking Joe a question, actually, I'm not so sure this is the right
Johnny.
Plan?
Johnny?
No, I think Johnny implements the plan. I could be wrong.
I think Johnny has the scope and he has the bottle and I think those conversations do happen.
Yeah.
But I think he probably...
Is he on his own? Is Peter O'Mahony doing his Rory Best? I mean,
I don't know, there's
a lot of strong characters over the years in the golden generation of rugby who, in my mind, would in a healthy way challenge the coach, not in a rebellious way. And I don't know, is that happening in the group? Because no, like there was, my brother's a boring historian, but he was telling me during the week about some quote from a Prussian general that said, "No battle plan survives contact with the enemy," in that you can have as many plans as you want, but at some point you've got to be reactive to what's happening in front of you. And we don't seem to be that way. We seem to just continually persist with what we've been told to do. You know,
our equivalent on this show is everyone has a plan to get punched in the face. But I like you
bringing
the
Mike Tyson
culture to the show. That's good, Andy.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, like Jimmy's winning matches. Jimmy McGuinness hijacked teams for a year, but then everyone looked at the plan and it stopped being successful.
It now feels like we're the one everyone's cottoned onto. Yeah. Is there any argument that it's too late in the day? I love your vision. You know, players, and let's express ourselves and let's go out there and you know, not rely on what we've relied on. Are we now at the point, though, where that's actually too late in the day and we need to revert to some good old-fashioned cup rugby? Get those box kicks going again. Let's play pressure rugby. Let's get our defence in order. And that's the best way for us to see our way through this tournament.
We could definitely do that.
Yeah.
We could. Like, Joe coached the team that beat Northampton. And again, got their arses handed to them for 40 minutes. And by halftime in the European Cup final, within 15 minutes, they fundamentally changed the way they were playing. The England, probably the greatest World Cup winning side in 03 under Woodward. It probably wasn't well discussed at the time. But Woodward had a plan. They were losing to Wales in the quarter final. When he left the room, Martin Johnson, Delalio, Matt Dawson, Wilkinson, Greenwood, Jason Leonard, just said, "We're not doing it as a group." And they went out and changed fundamentally how they were playing. There are times when in 15 minutes, with that level of talent, you can change exactly what you want to do. You take the shackles off.
It would be breaking the habit of six very successful years, though.
It would, yeah.
So it's unlikely to happen.
It's unlikely, but it could. And I also hear your point. We could just double down on all the things we have been good at and keep trying. And that's legit as well.
I do think he's moving things on behind the scenes.
What are you seeing on that front, by the way?
I'm seeing the multi-phase play is something that we've heard Brian O'Driscoll in here saying that he's heard they work on. I thought we saw it in the Italy game. We saw the way Carberry floated behind the front line in the way that Owen Farrell does, waiting for his moment. We saw the pullback pass from Chris Farrell. Mm. We saw a bit more handling within the 22. It wasn't just bish, bash, bosh. They were waiting for the moment to strike. I think that their counter-attacking game looks a lot more interesting. I'm not going to say it's sharper because they haven't been able to implement it because anytime Joe has tried to move things on, it's taken a few, you know, Joe's seasons with Leinster always started slowly. Mm. Even his first couple of games for Ireland was the Australia defeat was the week before the All Blacks game that everyone kind of almost forgets. That's up there in the list of his worst ever defeats. I think it's fourth. So I think he's trying to move it on behind the scenes, and I think there's a bit of growing pains with that.
Mm.
And I think that's probably feeding a little bit into the performances. And when you're getting beaten up, it's much harder to try those things. I think we might see a bit of back to basics this week, because I think there is just a need to win and a bit of a need to restore a bit of pride into the group and the jersey. Mm. But I do think everything we hear about Japan is it's going to be very much a top of the ground World Cup, that, you know, the conditions are warm, the ground is hard, and it's not going to suit a team that's just trying to run over their opposition. I think he recognises that. We even saw, like, Tadhg Furlong, a little tip-on pass that we haven't maybe seen in the build-up to the Irish try on Saturday, that we almost forget it happened at this stage because so much bad things happened afterwards. I do think there are signs, but, you know, he's trying to do it without Johnny and without Joey.
Mm.
And he's kind of doing it with two out halves. One has made his first start, one has never made a start. They're both know there's a World Cup on the line for them and they've no experience. Mm. So that isn't a help. And he's also doing it with terrible balls. So I do think they're trying to move stuff on, and I think maybe over the next 2 weeks we'll see it. I think maybe you go, you beat Scotland, and then you use your next three games and those weeks of training, but it all comes down to that one game against Scotland in a couple of weeks' time, which is a bit scary right now because it's around 20 days, 22 days maybe, and you know, right now the form is pretty bleak.
In a break with tradition, Schmidt held a press conference yesterday.
Yeah.
It was very unusual at Carlton House. It's about 11 minutes of what I've seen anyway. We put it up on YouTube. I thought it was really authoritative. Mm. It was really in control, calm, matter of fact, not deluded either, engaging with the reality of how bad the performance was on Saturday, but mapping a way out of it in very definite terms. It was impressive. I know you were there, Rory, just to give people at home a sense. Here's about 2 minutes of Schmidt speaking at Carlton House yesterday.
Look, it's an unacceptable result for us. It was a performance beneath where we'd like to be. It's a performance beneath where we need to be. And I think the whole group are very, very conscious that we have a short period of time to make sure that we accelerate what is part of a progression. We did try to have a very rigorous pre-season, and the pre-season really ran up into the Portugal camp. We tried to taper a little bit at the end of the week, but really we looked flat, we looked slow, we were we were inaccurate, and we didn't adjust when we could see we were getting trouble in some areas. We didn't adjust and probably take some of the easier options that presented themselves, particularly to retain the ball or win the ball and then retain it. But I think to throw everything out would be a mistake. There were a couple of aspects of play that weren't too bad. I felt that we found a little bit of space in behind them a few times. There were a couple of glimpses of some pretty good structure and getting over the advantage line. And some pretty good defence a few times. We forced them into kicking because we forced them back defensively as well. Now, we didn't do that nearly often enough. We've got a count of 37 missed tackles. You know, for us to be below 80% in a tackle count when we're looking for 90% plus, you can't afford to offer a team the size, skill and experience of England that amount of latitude, and we gave them way too much latitude. Nothing mitigates losing the way we did, and we're not going to make excuses for that because we know where we are in our progression, and we've tried to periodise our lead into the World Cup. And I do think at this time of the year, or this time of the cycle, every 4 years you get some pretty, you know, I wouldn't say bizarre results, but you get some imbalanced results because different teams are in different stages. You know, I think one of the advantages for England is that they've had good clarity. They've named their 31. They know where they are at. It's their third game for most of our guys who played on Saturday. It's their first game, so I'm determined to stay realistic about where we are in comparison to our opponents last weekend. But where we have to be this weekend is a different story, and where we have to be the weekend after is another different story. And we need to see how much more competitive we can be in the space of a week. And there will be a number of changes for this coming weekend. And I know a number of people will anticipate that being the case because we are still in what we would determine a building phase, a clarification phase for selection. And, you know, once this weekend is over, effectively, selections are done.
So that was Joe Schmidt yesterday. Our rugby coverage with thanks to Vodafone, Team of Us, everyone in. We're here with Andy Dunn and Rory O'Connor, if you're just tuning in. You were there yesterday for the full Schmidt performance. It did carry an air of authority.
I thought it was almost a return to form in press conference style. Look, no one wins games in the press conference room, but I've been in nearly all of Joe's press conferences over the years, and I could have covered him at Leinster as well. And there was a self-assurance and a self-belief to him that we maybe was rattled a bit during the Six Nations. I think he walked away from Twickenham with a realisation that this wasn't going to turn itself around and almost realised the scale of the job, but it might have clarified a few things in his own mind. I believe there was a fairly honest dressing room afterwards. I think there was a few home truths told to a lot of people. I would imagine there was blood on the floor of the review room on Sunday night and Monday morning. I'd say no one walked out there with their reputations intact. I mean, whether that helps belief or confidence, I'm not sure, but I think it probably had to be done. I don't think that was an acceptable performance from an Irish team. And I think, like, the message is, you know, you could hear clearly what he was saying there about the performance. He was asked to back Rory Best. He did so, but not unequivocally. He said that selection is very much up for grabs, and I think the message to the players out there on Saturday is that you will be, if you show form, because of the timelines involved, you will be backed.
Okay.
And that is possibly something that, like, whenever you hear people who were there in 07, they all say that one thing that they did was they started chasing things and they abandoned their own plan. But also they said that the people on the fringes never thought they had a chance. Whereas I think maybe there's a bit more openness to selection now, and I think everyone you expect to go to Japan will go to Japan. But I don't think players that we would expect to see in the starting team will necessarily be in the starting team if others come in and take their chance in the next 2 weeks.
He talked there about trying to taper things off towards the end of Portugal and explain, you know, this must explain the flatness of Twickenham in some respects. What are the things from the Twickenham performance that worry you the most? As in, what are the things that a certain flatness doesn't explain away?
If you look at each player on one of those nice graphics you'll see, and you see his stats, and you look at him as an individual in isolation, and you consider the quality that is there, I think there's high quality there. We mightn't be as physically imposing if you compare the tail of the tape with your opposite number in the English team or the South African teams, but there is undoubted quality littered throughout the squad. And I think there's undoubted quality littered through the coaching staff, including Joe and Andy Farrell is a British Lion coach and one of the legends of rugby league with vast experience. Greg Feek, there's a lot of experience and quality on their individual profile. And then you look at a team performance as listless and flat as that, regardless of tapering in Portugal. My big worry is it a psychological kind of burnout that's happening, that just regardless of will and good intention to go out and play what we were trying to do, try and implement a plan, that is there any kind of element of burnout, the intensity levels required to be a player under Joe, to, you know, he is renowned for being detail oriented, you know, the video sessions, as Rory, maybe there was blood on the floor on Monday, but maybe there needed to be a couple of pizzas, you know, brought in, and just say, look, I can't get this vision out of my head. As you said something earlier, you can't get a vision out of your head at the broken chat. I met Steve Hansen in 2014 for a coffee in the Castleknock Hotel with Mick Byrne, and I can remember him chuckling away because he said, he goes, those poor Irish boys, he goes, they've probably done 7 hours video analysis each on us this week. Now, there were All Blacks walking around in the background in jeans and T-shirts. Three of the boys were getting in a helicopter to go on over aerial tour of Dublin. And he was chuckling away saying, and he was genuine in my mind, he was saying, we don't know what we're going to do on the field on Saturday. Mm. There ain't no way Ireland are going to know what we're going to do. I was coached by Rowley Meats in Leinster, who's a legend of the game through the 80s and 90s. And he had a very funny take on rugby. He would say at any rugby match he was ever at, 70% of the people there didn't know what was going on. And he was including the players, the referee, the coaching staff, not just the spectators. Because it is literally a game of huge ambiguity once the two teams meet. And I think it's just so worrying to see a group of that individual caliber, when they come together as apparently a cohesive unit, they look so bad as individuals and as a team. And to me, that's just a big, it's just a big leap. And I was like, I keep looking at it going, what's happening? And from my mind, there's not enough empowerment around players making enough decisions on the hoof that you like. We can.
No, I accept that point. You've been very consistent in that. In fairness, so that feels particularly relevant to attack. What about in defence? Like, what was going on that England were scoring our first phase of the 37 now missed tackles? 21 were in the first half, so you can't necessarily put all that down to tiredness. And too often, Stockdale finds himself with a bad decision or a worse decision, and Bundiaki's making some odd choices. Mm. Like, I would have thought, based on everything we hear, that defence was one of the easier things to get right and get set and put together a plan.
I don't think it's one of the easier things to get right. I think
is it not?
Not to my... No, I mean, people. You can...
We always hear defence first.
Yeah, defence first as a priority. It doesn't mean it's easy to implement a defensive system.
Okay.
I think it's...
I would have been operating under the impression it's easier than an attacking plan to put together.
I think it's easier to flick the switch for arousal levels and say, right, next week, okay, you're going to hit people harder and it matters more, but your defensive system is more complex, so you can't, I don't think you can fix it overly quickly.
Okay.
But, you know, you can, was it to a me, you can fix attack quicker.
Oh, can you? Okay. Well, then on defence, did you see it as a systematic failure or just individual
both
decisions?
Yeah, there were definitely, I don't know what you thought, right? I thought there were some obvious kind of individual errors, but no real obvious defensive format that was, you know, that you could sit back and look and say, okay, we're really a fast push defence, we're a rush defence, there's someone coming from the outside, we're a drift defence, we were kind of in between all of them at times.
Andy Farrell's defence is based on line speed and there was no line speed.
Yeah.
And there was bad decisions made as well, so the first try is the one that I think people are focusing back in on, because in fairness, that first 25 minutes was a pretty even game between two teams that looked reasonably well matched, even though England were winning collisions a bit more. But even then, you know, they just looked at sixes and sevens. It looked like they hadn't, like, you know, I know you said it's not necessarily, you know, the Steve Hansen story is relevant, but Joe does prize analysis. And I don't know how much analysis they would have done in England, because England are not a serious threat to the World Cup until the end of until we get to the end of October. So I wonder whether even during the week they did anywhere near the bit of analysis they normally would do. I think they were a bit spooked by Billy Vunipola. Which led to that first try.
He's not going anywhere either.
Oh, I know, absolutely.
By him now.
But I think that's what sucked in a load of people. I mean, there was bad decisions made, but Ireland have never defended that badly.
No.
Even during even the England game during the Six Nations, the tries, maybe one or two of them Ireland were carved open. One was an intercept. I think one that came off the line out, if I remember correctly. It feels like a long time ago now. Wales only scored one try in that game. That was a discipline and line out problem. The line out is actually where I'd be really focusing my concern, because I think they'll fix the defence much better. But the line out is.
Can line out not be fixed in a couple of sessions, no?
Well, I mean, it was really bad against Wales as well. I think there's an overreliance there.
We lost only 2 of 15.
They dirtied the ball up as well. It was sloppy. But like this, you're never going to lose 8 again.
Yeah.
But I mean, the two times Ireland looked really good in that first half, one, they're both offline. They scored the try off line out ball, and they also marched England back 15 metres with them all. Mm. I mean, if you got your line out right, if Ian Henderson and Rory Best were connecting, the timing was on, it's not just down to one person. Suddenly you can go to your maul. Ireland's maul was dominant. It was really effective. It only worked once, but it sat England back. Mm. Suddenly England are on the back foot. They're asking questions. They're getting players sucked in. There's more space. But if they know that they can go, and they only had 2 line-out jumpers in their team, so how Ireland weren't able to identify where Mauro Itoje and George Cruz were and avoid them, I'm still not sure. It was a bit of a failure of Ian Henderson's strategy. He seemed to call the ball on himself too much. It was a failure of Rory Best throwing at times, because they were dying in the air a little bit, and obviously fatigue and all sorts of things come into that. And also just the sloppy lifting. I mean, the one that Sean Cronin threw over Peter O'Mahony was timing, and also they never got him up. So it is fixable, but you're kind of, I think they want to move on a little bit from Devin Toner because he's not the most dynamic second row they have, but they keep having to go back to him because he's just the sure thing, especially when you can't trust your hooker in every game and your hooker is your captain and you have to pick him.
Who's meant to be starting at two on Saturday?
Scannell, I think. And then Best on the bench, I think. So he's I think Best and Tadhg Furlong are back on the bench. He wants to get a bit of run into them.
So if Best in particular maybe hadn't had the poor game he had, he probably wouldn't be on the bench.
Well, he was supposed to do a commercial gig today, which were pulled for increased training load. And Joe said yesterday during the papers bit of the press conference, he was asked about that, you know, because that happened and suddenly we heard Joe was up for press conferences and I was ringing people at training going, was Rory at training? You know, is this the moment? And obviously he was and he was back in the team. Joe said, we don't do commercial gigs when we're in the weeks that we're playing. So he had basically changed. Rory Best, okay. I don't think, planned to be involved this weekend. He is now, I think that shows that they feel he's off it. I don't know if if he's going out with the message, you know, play well or you're done, but I think Scannell will definitely feel that there's an opportunity to play himself into the team.
Yeah.
If they run the line out well.
Where are you on the Best situation, Andy?
From what I've been told by my front rower friends, who I'm growing to love more and more, they say he's a really good quality scrummager, which is integral to his selection. And he's a very respected captain. And he's joint first, would we say, as the thrower in terms of ability between him, Cronin. I don't, would Scannell be ahead of him as the thrower?
I think Scannell and Herring would be ahead of him.
Okay.
And Cronin's numbers, I think, are up in Leinster when he starts, but when he comes off the bench, he finds it difficult, which is a problem when Ireland use him exclusively as
a bench player.
A bench player. But Herring, I think, at Ulster, would be considered a better thrower, and Scannell would be fairly reliable at Munster in what is probably one of the best lineouts in Europe. Mm. I think.
That's interesting about Cronin. Although it will linger in the mind that he started in Rome.
Oh no, Rome I think possibly did for Sean Cronin as an Ireland player under Joe Schmidt, and his problem probably is that Andy Farrell's taken over and he's no spring chicken, and Cronin's well into his 30s now as well. But you look at, you know, Ireland haven't produced, I mean there's a reason more project players who've come over have been hookers than any other position. I think Tom McCartney would possibly be Ireland's starting hooker at this World Cup if he hadn't fallen off a cliff after Connacht won the Pro 14 in 2016. He looked every bit the player that Ireland were lacking at that time. He just wasn't there. The Reece Marshall down in Munster doesn't qualify yet. So you're left with four players and James Tracy possibly on the fringes, none of whom has shot the lights out and really grabbed it. I don't think anyone's put the heat on Rory Best to the extent that Joe felt like he could move on from him. Scannell had a decent year. Herring's problem is that he never went to Connacht or went somewhere else because he's been number two to Rory Best at Ulster. You know, he's the captain there as well, so he's kind of never had his opportunity. But they went and won in Australia without Best. All the hookers went well in that tour. They all looked really good. You know, I've been pretty consistent in saying that it was a big World Cup risk to hitch your wagon to 37. A man who'll be 37 at the tournament. I just don't think he offers you enough around the park. I mean, you look at, say, the Dane Coles or Cody Taylor in New Zealand. Mm. You look at the two hookers, Marks at South Africa, you know, across, Jamie George is just, he's probably the best in the world right now. Ireland aren't getting that from their hooker. Now, he hits a lot of rooks, that's what he says his role is.
They get it from Cronin almost.
Yeah, well, Cronin's the most exciting hooker in Europe.
Yeah.
But he's just not, it's not even a talking point that you can start.
I know it's not going to happen. I'm going to drag it up though, because he doesn't miss lineouts as consistently with Ireland as he does with the same two jumpers for Leinster, with James Ryan, Devin Toner. So who can explain that one?
I'd say he gets a bit of love in Leinster as well. I'd say the arm is around the shoulder and he's
certain players need to be managed a certain way to get the best out of them. If you all have a template and everyone must comply by the template, you lose characters, you lose
Leinster
Mavericks.
Leinster builds strike plays around their hooker because he's so explosive and dynamic in the loose. Now, he's not as good a scrummager and he's not a captain. He's not the captain of the team and you're suddenly out and they don't have a massive leadership group. I think a lot of the squad is quite young and I do think they value that group of O'Mahony, Sexton and Best very, very highly, and I think it will be a big wrench for them to move on. But I do think if Scannell goes really well this weekend and Best comes on off the bench and doesn't affect the game, I think I think Best will go as a touring captain, but I don't think his place is completely watertight because Joe Schmidt has to be rootless and cutthroat in the next couple of weeks because his legacy is on the line.
Yeah.
And he's not going to let Rory Best sink the ship.
Andy Dalton went to the 87 World Cup for the All Blacks as captain, and Sean Fitzpatrick started the final.
Okay. An area of the pitch, because the clock's coming against us, in complete flux now, has to be the Irish back road, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything's up for grabs there. Almost nothing's off the table on the Irish back row right now.
The problem is he can only bring five of them. So he now has to make big calls. And, you know, CJ Stander didn't play well. His numbers were just so much lower than...
Is it right that it was three carries?
Yes. Well, the last time I looked, I know they revised them, but it was three carries for 15 metres, I think, and it was quite a low number. His tackle count was okay.
Okay.
But he was so... He just didn't see him out there. He looks like his body shape has changed with all the training that they've done, which is possibly going to come good. And, you know, maybe he'll start next week and he'll have gained from that experience. Yeah. But he hasn't been as effective for the last year. I would have Conan in. I'm not ruling out CJ being at six, but I just think Jack Conan is the all-rounder Ireland need in that back row. He does everything. He's got the ball carrying. Him and James Ryan are in this weekend, and that will just give Ireland a bit more oomph. And it looks like Pete is moving to seven with Tadhg Byrne at six, which is a good breakdown threat. He's not a traditional seven, but it might get him into the game a little bit more. So that'll be interesting to see how he goes, because whenever he's gone seven before in this World Cup cycle, CJ's been on the pitch, and CJ's often actually been the open side, even though he's wearing six on his back. So I think it's going to be an interesting back row to watch. It's quite tall. There's a lot of, like, that's five line-out options.
Yeah.
You've got two second rows, because Dev's not playing, but Ian Henderson is. You've got two second rows and three jumping back rows. Niall Scanlon's got a lot to hit this weekend. A lot of tall lifters.
Has Pete been training in seven, or is there talk of that?
As far as I know, he's captaining the team from seven this weekend.
I think that's really interesting. That's a bit of novelty now. Chirped me up.
That's the kind of Will Addison's fullback. You know, he's a guy who could come in, have him not played at all, and suddenly he could light things up. He could slip into 13.
Yeah.
You know, there is Chris Farrell's back. I think Chris Farrell's a live option. If you're getting bullied in midfield, you've suddenly got this monster man.
I should have actually said, so the kind of reported guessing on the team for Saturday is Addison fullback, Conway on the wing. Interestingly, Gordon Darcy said Jordan Larmour not a winger. Conway maybe ahead of him now as a utility back. But Farrell and Bundiaki, Farrell at 13, Stockdale on the wing, Jack Carty in a 10 with Marmion, then Kilcoyne, Scannell, Ryan, Henderson and James Ryan, and then Tadhg Byrne at 6, Peter Romani 7, Jack Conan at 8. How did Ross Byrne do? Because I've seen him generally criticised in various quarters for being far too deep in Twickenham.
Just on the back, I love the sound of that back row, by the way. Just... as an aside,
Tadhg Byrne, Peter Romani, Jack Conan. Absolutely. A bit more oomph about that field.
Jesus, I love the sound of that. Yeah, I can't wait to see that.
And we'll perch you up. We're back.
Did I smile? Did I just smile?
Unionisation is coming good.
Thank you.
Quick word on Ross Byrne for us.
I think Ross Byrne, I would hope history will judge him kindly based on that England game. Very hard to come into a team for your first cap that's getting that much of a beating all around you.
Yeah.
And it's a natural reaction to go a bit deeper. As a result, when you've got 12, you know, bulls in white shirts clawing the floor with their feet because your ball is that slow. The one glaring mistake, which is, you know, you say a schoolboy error when you're under pressure, is the ball passed into the 22 and he kicks it into touch. But I would never crucify a young out half or something like that, given the pressure he was under. If, you know, for the best part of 18 months, he's been very central to some of Leinster's success, and he's quite understated.
He's
a good
kicker. Like, you can't write a guy. Yeah, you can't write 18 months of excellent kicking.
No, not at all. So. I think you got to make allowances for the general
depth.
Well, the general kind of destruction that was going on around him. You know.
Okay. So we'll have to leave it there. So Wales Saturday, Cardiff, and then we reconvene, and we'll have a better feel for where the whole thing is.
I think the World Cup starts on Saturday week when Ireland's first team, or the shape of Ireland's first team, takes on the shape of Wales' first team in a bit of a Warren Gatland special. I feel Ireland will get back to winning ways this weekend. I think that there's a lot of hurt in that place, and I think that they're going to be determined to show that they're not that team, and I think that could come out against a fairly callow Welsh team, and then the Aviva in 2 weeks' time is looking very tasty.
Okay. Rory O'Connor from the Irish Independent. Andy Dunn, pleasure, lads. Thank you.
Cheers, Joe.
Cheers, Joe.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.